landing on the equator was pretty exciting. We, you know, I've been sailing since I was a kid, and I was really keen to not just fly over the equator, but also cross it as a boat. So after I'd crossed the equator, I did a U-turn, you know, did a downwind leg, came back and landed just south of the equator, taxied across, and then took off again. So that was in the middle of the ocean, which I, you know, in hindsight was pretty silly, but at the time it seemed like a really cool idea.
G'day and welcome everyone to episode number 14 of On The Step with That Mallard Guy. I'm your host, Dan Bolton. Great to have you all back listening to another seaplane story, and I must say today's guest very much sums up the two words, seaplane and adventure. You'll see why in just a second when we hear his incredible story. Before we get into the interview, I just wanted to start out with an Apple Podcast review shout out from BJ Great, that's GR8, who titled his review as Great Resource for Budding Seaplane Pilots and said, as a pilot who spent a few years flying floats around Australia, I can tell you this podcast pretty much hits the nail on the head with describing the challenges and joys of the industry. I love the format. Well worth a listen. Thanks for the kind words, BJ. Great. You are great, BJ. And I really appreciate all the support you guys are giving me across email, Instagram, and especially those reviews. Thank you so very much. And as usual, to get in touch with me, my email is thatmallardguy@hotmail.com. And you can find me on Instagram @thatmallardguy. Send me a direct message there. Please say hello. Ask me a question. Suggest a guest, whatever you want to say, I'll check it out and get back to you as I do with everybody else. I do have a request for you all though, for those of you who are loving the stories, which is most of you I know, please help out the show by sharing with your friends, telling people about the show and rating the show as well via Apple Podcasts, if that's what you're listening on. It helps get it out there into all parts of the world to find those people with the best seaplane stories for you all to enjoy. It's not just about me, it's about all of you. So that is my request for you out there to help On The Step grow and get some interesting stories and people on the show. But for now, folks, let's get straight into episode 14's guest. Go out and get the world map. Plan out a seaplane journey around the globe. And strap into the pilot seat because we're going to get going on the step on a circumnavigation of Earth. Okay, that intro sounds completely random, but I promise it will make sense in just a moment. You'll see.
Right engine is turning. 12% fuel. A light.
Okay, welcome Michael Smith to On The Step, mate. How are you going?
Oh, pretty good.
That's the go. Now, for those out there, if you haven't heard of the name Michael Smith, now back in 2015, Michael started a personal journey recreating the 1930s Qantas Empire Imperial flying boat route from Rose Bay in Sydney all the way through to Southampton in England in his two-seat Sea Ray amphibian. Now, after completing that sector, Michael was pushed by his wife to keep going and complete a circumnavigation of the globe. After 7 long months, Michael became the first person to solo circumnavigate the globe in a flying boat, earning him the 2016 Australian Geographic Adventurer of the Year. Michael, it gives me goosebumps just remembering and talking about your journey, mate. Has it all sunk in?
No, I must say, because I've told the story so many times, it now actually feels like I'm like telling this story about someone else. But every now and again, you know, something pops up in my diary or something happens and I just think, wow. You know, this time last year. So, you know, at the moment, what is it, the end of May? So this time last year, I think I was landing on Lake Como, you know, with a week to go before I got to London. So, yeah, pretty amazing to think that's 5 years ago.
Yeah, crazy, mate. It's an epic story. And for those who haven't actually heard it, Michael's written an amazing book called Voyage of the Southern Sun. And there's also a DVD because you recorded most of the adventure on your GoPro, and there's a DVD out, Voyage of the Southern Sun, which is amazing. We watched it in a very cool theatre up in Darwin here, because I know you love theatres as well.
Yep.
But you can definitely check those out. I'll have a link in the description of this podcast down below. Yeah. Mate, was there any highlights? I know we're not going to focus too much on that trip because you've done a few trips recently that really are new and in a new aircraft as well. So we're going to focus on that very shortly. But what were the real highlights on that trip that really stood out in a flying boat aspect?
Ah, from a flying boat, yeah, because, you know, my usual answer is, you know, the flying was great, but it's the people I met on the ground that, really made it special.
We don't care about traveling, mate. We want to talk flying boats here.
Flying boats. So, yeah, look, and that's good. I don't often get asked that. Look, from a flying boat point of view, landing on Lake Como was an absolute highlight. You know, that very old flying boat base there, I was very well received. So, and just a beautiful part of the world to be flying on the water. So that was pretty cool. Landing on the equator was pretty exciting.
Yep.
We, I've been sailing since I was a kid, and I was really keen to not just fly over the equator, but also cross it as a boat. So after I'd crossed the equator, I did a U-turn, did a downwind leg, came back and landed just south of the equator, taxied across and then took off again. So that was in the middle of the ocean, which I in hindsight was pretty silly, but at the time it seemed like a really cool idea. Probably the two highlights in America were flying the length of the Mississippi in a flying boat was just epic. It took me a week. I set myself the mission that having left Florida, I was going to go to New Orleans and then follow the Mississippi all the way to its source, and that I was going to follow every bend all the way. And it turns out there's a lot of bends in the Mississippi River. So it took about a week, but, you know, being in a flying boat, I was landing on the river at lunchtime. I was landing regularly. If, you know, you'd sometimes literally you'd come around a corner and then there was fog ahead. So you'd land and let that clear, or I'd land on the Mississippi and tie up to a tree at night and just sleep in the plane. And eventually I made it all the way up to the source, landed on the lake and, just shut down the engine. And it was about noon, so I ate my lunch and just thought, wow, it's, you know, to go from that mighty Mississippi down the south where it's so industrial and so wide and, you know, quite a brutal river, to the little kind of meter and a half wide trickle at the top up at its source was pretty cool. But then the final thing was heading out into the Aleutian Islands, and I ended up getting stuck in the Aleutians for quite a while waiting for permission to land in Russia that never came through. So I found myself with 3 weeks on ADAC, and I went exploring. I mean, I flew out to Attu and back, ferrying some fuel. I landed, I went to a few of the islands, and I landed on lakes. And again, in retrospect, you know, like there weren't too many options out there, but yeah, you'd go to an island and there'd be freshwater lakes and you'd land and think, wow, I am hundreds of miles from anywhere. But it was uber cool, that part of the world. And they would be the few highlights, I think.
Absolutely, mate. And I remember the Aleutian Islands story as well. That was one of my favorite parts about your trip, I think. Do you know that ferrying fuel for say 6 hours just to be able to have fuel at a random location in the middle of nowhere to be able to then cross over to get to Japan, wasn't it? Like the big overwater leg?
Yeah, the really quick version is that I couldn't get permission to land in Russia. So ADAC's the last inhabited place as you go westwards from America. So I was able to get fuel there, but it was going. I'd actually managed, and I know a lot of listeners will know the Sea Ray, and they probably, because you've got so many commercial guys listening, but the Sea Ray is probably seen as a bit of a toy. She's a great little adventure craft, but more of a weekend, you know, lake hopper to pick up a hamburger. But I'd managed to squeeze 21 hours of fuel tanks into the Sea Ray, which. She was a little bit overweight, but she still flew okay at that weight. But I'd worked out it was going to take 22 hours to fly direct from ADAC to Japan. So, you know, that would not work.
And that's without autopilot as well. Jesus.
Yeah, no autopilot. I did the whole trip hand flying. I thought without this Russian permission, the trip was going to be over. But I was searching Google Earth, being just so determined that I've come this far, there must be a way. And having given up on options like Midway and going down to Hawaii and various things because the range didn't work, I found Attu, you know, the abandoned runway on the old Coast Guard station and what was also a World War II base. And I worked out that if I flew 6 hours out and left some fuel on the runway in containers, flew back to ADAC, filled up the fuel again, flew 6 hours back, that it would only be a 19-hour flight to Japan. So, you know, 19 hours in a Sea Ray over the Pacific Ocean, sorry, with 14 hours of that at night was a pretty, pretty demanding trip.
So brutal. Mate, you've definitely made the Sea Ray not your weekend warrior hamburger grabber. It's made an adventure around the world, you know.
I must say, I know a lot. I've had so many letters from people who, you know, having heard the story, have gone and bought a Sea Ray. And look, it is a great little plane, you know. And I know it's kind of rudimentary, but especially in the world where the Icon A5 exists, and you know, they're both fantastic planes. But I think, you know, and when you're speaking to the guys at the Sea Ray factory, they're always worrying that, oh, look, the Icon's so this and it's so that. But the Icon's almost like a Cirrus, where the Sea Ray's more like a, you know, a cub, like the Carbon Cub or something, because it's, you know, the Carbon Cub's just a magnificent bush plane that can do anything. And the Sea Ray's a bit like that too, whereas the Icon's very sleek, but it's very expensive. And, yeah, so there's a certain market that that's a great plane. But the Sea Ray can kind of, you know, it can go pretty much anywhere, and I have landed it in a 2-foot sea, you know, 2-foot waves, and she will handle it. It's very tough, very strong. It's just, you know, it's just pretty basic, but, you know, anyone with basic boating experience can kind of look after and maintain that plane as well. So, yeah, she's got a lot going for it.
Hey, mate, the last time you and I caught up, that was late last year in Darwin. You were on another adventure coming from Russia, but also recreating another flight. Tell us a little bit about that one.
Yeah, sure. So, look, the thing, having completed my round-the-world trip, you know, a bit like Jaws, I realised I needed a bigger boat. And I had all of these trips in my mind that I wanted to do that really this, you know, I was pretty lucky to finish that Sea Ray trip, and I thought I'd kind of push my luck with what I was doing in a single-engine plane. So I went looking for a twin-engine plane, and I found one in Russia, and maybe we'll have a bit of more of a chat about the plane later.
Absolutely,
but
yeah.
So I went and picked up that plane, and I needed to get it home. You know, if I just wanted to get home, I probably could have done it in a couple of weeks and, you know, jumped over Afghanistan and Middle East down through Asia and got home. But it also happened that it was the 100th anniversary last year of the first flight from London to Australia. And I personally think that this is a really important story that's been a little bit forgotten in Australia. You know, we know a lot about Kingsford Smith crossing the Pacific. And then, you know, years later, we had Dick Smith being the first person to fly around the world in a helicopter. But in 1919, the Smith brothers flew in a Vickers Vimy World War I bomber from London out to Australia. They managed to do it in 28 days. And it was the most incredible trip of the time. You know, there are people who compare it to the moon landing 50 years later. It was such a big deal. At that time, the longest trip, I think, had been about 3,000 nautical miles. And, you know, this was 10. And it really caught the world's attention. So there had been plans to recreate that trip with an electric air race, but it turned out that wasn't possible. So I just didn't want to let it lie. And I thought, you know, it meant flying from Russia to London, but I was really keen to retrace the trip. My plan was to leave on the same day that they did, on October the, I've forgotten, 12th or 10th, and then land in Darwin 28 days later, the same day they did. But unfortunately, I got a bit delayed in Russia with some, you know, good old paperwork, and ended up leaving on the 19th of October, sorry, the 19th of November. And but I was still determined to make it to Darwin by December the 10th. So I only had 3 weeks, but I was really keen to follow all of the same places they went to. I, you know, a bit like when I did the 1938 flying boat route retracing, which I ended up doing Pan Am routes and other things. You know, I love using these old trips as kind of the guiding light to planning a trip, because it gives you a sense of history. It makes it interesting storytelling. You know, it's great. I was reading the book that they wrote. I'd already read the book that Ross Smith wrote years ago, but I was rereading it again on the trip. And there was even a National Geographic magazine published in 1920 where the entire edition was dedicated to this trip because it was such a big deal. So I actually had that with me, and I set myself the task of going to all of the same cities that they went to and to try and take the same photos that they did that were published in the book and in the National Geographic magazine. So, you know, I left from England in similar conditions to them, pretty late in the season, so there was snow on the ground and then some pretty hairy weather getting over the Mediterranean through France and Italy. But I, you know, most of the places I was able to go to, all of the same cities, it was fantastic. Having been through Europe before, to find myself down in Egypt where they'd been and to fly over the pyramids and do some, you know, some really, really cool things that I know a lot of people dream of. But it's interesting to look at, you know, I wanted to look at how has the world changed in those 100 years. And in many ways, the VFR flying that I was doing, because I should point out I'm a, you know, just a private VFR pilot, I found myself dealing with the same weather issues they were. And, you know, the usual bureaucracy that any delivery pilot knows about getting in and out of countries. So the changes, though, were things like, you know, they were able to fly straight over the pyramids at a few hundred feet and take a photo. But the minimum height you're allowed to fly over Egypt as a VFR aircraft is 8,500 feet.
Yeah, wow.
So it's pretty hard to get those photos. And, in fact, they decided in Egypt, for instance, that they didn't even want me, because I wanted to fly over the Sinai Desert heading to Jordan, they wanted me to fly at 13,000 feet. And, I'm in the new plane, doesn't have oxygen, but, it's capable of going that high. But I was at my limits personally, so that there were some interesting discussions when they actually were they were trying to get me to go to 23,000 feet, and we actually compromised on 13,000.
Yeah, right.
So I gave myself, I was flying every day, sort of 2 or 3 days in a row, and then I'd give myself a day off to look around. But I was managing to get the photos and, you know, meeting the people on the ground. But from a flying boat point of view, I'm sorry to say that there was very little flying boat activity, because I was retracing a trip done by a land plane and also the insurance company had also said I wasn't allowed to land on the water during the delivery trip. But before I left Russia, we did a heap of water flying, which was awesome, in the town of Samara.
Yeah, we'll jump into the aircraft in just a moment. But I'd just like to ask, I've flown in Vietnam before, but that was all kind of set up prior to me getting there. But without going into too much detail, how does someone go from flying, you know, from Russia to back to Australia planning wise, like? Are you doing it all yourself, or are you using, you know, another company to help you out with all the contacting between each country? Like, how does that all work?
Yeah, look, it is a lot of work. Unfortunately, the planning takes longer than the flying. I use a company in England who's a handling agent who organises the overflight permits, and then he gets the permission to land in each country, but then he puts me in contact with the local agents. And you know, you always have to do a flight plan because you're crossing an international border. Even though I'm flying VFR, most of the flying you're treated like an IFR flight. So, any international flight, they're tracking you, and most of the places you have to have an ADS-B transponder. But the paperwork, some of it's very easy. Some of the permissions come through within a matter of days, but some take weeks. I went into places like Israel, which is a lot more involved. They have a lot of security requirements to be allowed to fly there. And in fact, one of the things I was trying to do was fly straight from Egypt into Israel, retracing the route of, you know, to follow where the plane went. But Egypt's relationship with Israel isn't very good. And, I kept putting in my flight plan on that morning, and I'd been told it was possible, but no matter what flight plan I put in, the tower kept rejecting it. And they just, between Egypt and Israel, they couldn't get the permission to work. So even though I had written permission to do it, no flight plan was being approved. And in the end, I had to hurriedly get a permit to go to Jordan and land there for 1 hour and then take off and then go into Israel. So there's a lot of that stuff that you think you've got organized and then you just have to deal with on the fly. So I got delayed in Egypt a couple of days sorting that out. Flying in Europe itself is pretty easy. Flying in the main European countries is really no harder than Australia or America. But once you're into Asia and the Middle East, it gets reasonably complicated. They're pretty strict. They as I say, they treat you like an IFR flight. They want you to stay in contact the whole time, and they get pretty shirty when you do, you know, fall off the grid, because you're, you know, if you're VFR and you're down at 8,000 feet, you're not always able to stay in contact. You know, when, for instance, flying towards Pakistan and I'm still 500, 600 miles away, but you're crossing their airspace, they get pretty annoyed that you're not able to communicate with them all the way in Pakistan, down in Karachi. But they seem to fail to understand that you're not at 38,000 feet with all of that extra altitude. So, yeah, the paperwork is a lot of work, but it's just what you have to do, and it can get a bit frustrating. Though one of the other complications for me was the plane has Rotax engines, and I was pretty determined to get MoGas as much as possible because it's better for the engines and a fraction of the price. A lot of, you know, people love to complain about the cost of Avgas, and in Australia it's usually you know, a couple of bucks a litre, and in America it's, you know, what is it, about $1 US a litre. But there were parts of the world through there where Avgas is $4, $5, even $6 US a litre.
Wow.
So that makes, you know, the filling up just hideously expensive. So a lot of pre-organisation went into getting the handling agents to get 44-gallon drums of car petrol to the airport.
Yeah. And, mate, what about when you got to Darwin? I know, you know, there was a bit of a reception there waiting for you. I was standing back there taking as many Instagram videos as I could to try and capture you coming in. And, you know, I think you got there maybe a few minutes early, so you had to kind of hold a little bit because you wanted to touch down right on time. How was it feeling, you know, coming in there and saying that you've done it, you know, 100 years later to the minute, you've retraced the Smith journey?
Look, I must say that felt awesome. I mean, I was in Timor the night before, and, you know, I had such itchy feet. Like, you're so, you know, when you set yourself the task that you want to land 100 years to the minute since the other plane did, yeah, I was up early and I was pretty anxious. And I found myself down at the airport early and taking off early and, of course, therefore being early. And so I was going to be landing an hour early. And so I had to slow the plane down, and I was kind of doing these S's out north of Darwin, and I ended up slowing the plane down to 80 knots for the last hour, and which is pretty slow in this plane. But then I kind of realised, oh, well, that's the plane that the Vickers Vimy actually cruised at, so I did that last hour. But, you know, and it nearly didn't happen because there was quite a bit of weather, classic Darwin afternoon weather.
Yeah.
And they were going to bring me in on I've forgotten which runway it was, but the runway they wanted me to land on, because there were people waiting at the end to see me land, there was literally lightning hitting the ground at the end of that runway. So I landed on the cross runway. So what does that put? The lightning about a mile away. And but we did, with the help of the awesome ATC guys at Darwin Airport, touchdown on the minute, which was, yeah. So that felt great. And to be taxiing in, and I had a sense that something was happening in Darwin, but I had no idea the big reception they had planned for me. And so as I was taxiing in and I saw the two fire trucks with the water arch going for me, that felt pretty amazing. And then, of course, just after you pass under that, you can't see where you're going because the window's covered in water.
You don't have a prop wash to wash it all away, do you, in the twin?
But luckily this plane has a windscreen wiper, which is a nice addition. So I was able to clear that. But then, because there was lightning in the area, they made me park, and I had to wait for customs and immigration to come out and see me. And so the reason you guys were all delayed inside waiting for me was because customs and immigration wouldn't come out onto the tarmac while there was lightning in the area. Yeah. But one of the guys one of them just decided, oh, look, bugger it, I'll go and help him out. So he came out anyway, and we got started with things, and we we, you know, put the can of spray in and did all of that. But look, it felt pretty good. And when I came upstairs and realised the huge turnout that was there, it felt pretty fantastic. You know, especially when I finished the circumnavigation and no one had known what I was doing. I think there were about 20 people when I landed because, you know, we only told my family about it. So to have Darwin Major Events turn this into a pretty big thing and have school groups involved and all of that was, yeah, it felt pretty special.
Yeah, it was really cool to be up there. And, you know, I was sending you messages on the day saying, let's catch up. I want to check out this plane. And then, you know, Michael Smith's been ushered away by like a celebrity and poor little Dan's standing over in the corner, can't get a word in. But we were able to catch up the next day, mate. You had the aircraft on display at the museum, the Darwin Aviation Museum, which came over and had a look. And we might as well just jump into talking about this special little aeroplane that you've got now, mate, because it is, it's a pretty new amphibian flying boat that's on the market now from Russia. It's the Seabear aircraft. Mate, why don't you tell us all about it?
Yeah, look, she's a pretty impressive little plane. You know, when I was looking for a new plane, I actually thought it didn't exist. And what I really wanted was a half-size Catalina. And I went over to Oshkosh and I met with people. And I knew that, you know, to find an all-composite twin-engine flying boat, the only thing I'd seen that was close was the Gooey Duck up in Seattle, which I think is a magnificent plane. I actually, when I was on my circumnavigation, I stayed with those guys. Walter, hi, if you're listening, I'm sure you are. And, you know, they were such great hosts and they took me for flying the Gooey Duck. And I thought that is the ultimate plane, like for where we are today, to have something that was, you know, around sort of somewhere in size between a widgeon and a goose, that's all composite, with great load carrying capacity, a huge range. I thought would be great.
Was it based on the widgeon, was it?
Yeah, it's kind of like, I think it's similar to the widgeon, but a bit bigger.
Yeah, right.
I think it does sit halfway between a widgeon and a goose, but with a really nice hull form. But, you know, the $1 million price tag, I think it was looking at like about $1 million US for the kit plus, and you've got to build it. And, you know, you've still got an experimental plane. You know, and I'm kind of doing okay, but I don't have that sort of money, if that kind of makes sense. So I just couldn't afford that. Or more to the point, I couldn't justify that on the home front. But I kept thinking about it, and I went looking, and I actually approached some people at Oshkosh, you know, saying, look, what I want is someone to design me a plane that's half the size of a Catalina, but basically looks like it. I want to get it built in composite as a one-off plane. How do we go about that? Well, everyone was talking over $1 million to do it, and you could just tell it was one of those projects that could start and maybe never finish. So I kind of went back to the drawing board, and I ended up going down the rabbit hole on some YouTube videos. And I think we all know what happens when you start, you know, someone sends you a YouTube video and then there's five more on the side that says, oh, if you like this, you might be interested in this. And I came across this video of some guys flying boats in Russia, and they were doing tests. And I love what they were doing. They were test flying. How much weight can we carry in this plane and still be able to take off? So the amazing way the Russians approach that is, well, what you do is you put four people in the plane and take off. Then you come back in, you get one more guy to come in and you take off. And if that's successful, you get one more guy to jump in and you take off. And so this plane comes in and eight guys get out of it. and I thought, oh, I like these guys. So I go hunting down, and I kind of track down this plane, which I think at the time was called the L-44 or an L-72. I don't quite remember which one it was I saw, but it's a company called Chaika, and I tracked them down. But they don't have a website in English, and I managed to send off a message to them, and I get a reply back in English and basically say, look, I'm really interested in what you guys are doing. It's kind of the right size for what I'm wanting. And after a couple of emails, I just said, look, I'll jump on a plane and come and see you, because, you know, sometimes that's just the best way. So I travel to Europe a bit for work anyway. So I find myself in a place called Samara, which is about 500 or 600 nautical miles east of Russia on the Volga River. Now, the Volga River is the largest river in Europe. It flows entirely through Russia and is a beautiful big river. And the town of Samara has a long aviation history. Their university still teaches aeronautical engineering. And it's the town where they built the rockets that took, you know, Yuri Gagarin and Sputnik into space.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and so there's quite a lot of aviation history there. But the university still study flying boat design as part of their aeronautical engineering. And what I found was a small airfield where there were three different companies in this town building flying boats, but they all emanate from one design that was done about 25 years ago in this very interesting format. And it highlights that when someone's developing something in isolation from the rest of the world, they come up with different solutions. So what they all had in common was that it was a flying boat with rear access, and they'd come up with this idea that by having a V-tail, and if you picture the door on the back of an SUV or a hatchback car, the back of the plane opens up so that you can step out of the plane either out of the side, or literally you open the hatchback and you stand on the tail and you walk off the back of the plane. So there are no side doors. And what that does is that gives you an interior volume, and they do either a 4, a 6, or an 8 seat plane where you walk into the back of the plane and then you walk forward. So there's room, a lot of room between the seats to walk forward, and you end up with a really voluminous plane, but no side doors. And look, I really liked the look of what I was seeing. And we took it for a fly. And I have to say, it was just magnificent. It flies beautifully. And I just fell in love with this thing. But I didn't want to just kind of get carried away and order one on the spot. So I went home and I thought about it for a few months and I couldn't stop thinking about it. So I got on another commercial flight another time and went back to sit down and really nut out, well, you know, what are we going to do? Because it turns out these guys had never exported a plane before. They built about 30 of them over 20 years, and they were up to the point of building about 3 planes a year. So it's a very small factory, building the 4-seater and the 6-seater. But it was, you know, it was really high quality what they were doing. I mean, my family has a background in boat building, and the layups I was seeing in these hulls was so strong. It was the kind of construction that you'd see in a beautifully built racing yacht. But they also were using European engines and Western electronics. So it was the hull and the wings and the tail that was all Russian, but everything else they were using imported goods. So, you know, there was a confidence there that by buying this plane, I wasn't buying something that couldn't be serviced overseas. They were using Rotax engines, the Airmaster propellers from New Zealand, and either Garmin or MGL electronics. So, you know, it kind of felt they're all the things I had in the Sea Ray. So it felt like something I was comfortable with. And I ended up ordering one. And what we came up with was, for me, I had some very specific requests around some range opportunity and the features. So I said they built a 4- and a 6-seater, but the 4-seater they built had Rotax engines, but the 6-seater used a pair of Lycomings. And I must say, I'm not a fan of kind of the old-fashioned heavy metal engines. And so what I put to them, and it turned out it was something they were already thinking about, was doing the 6-seater hull in a lighter layup using the new Rotax 915 engine, which, you know, is 140 horsepower side, to kind of come up with a hybrid in between. So what we came up with was the L65, and I configured it for, rather than 6 full-size seats, it's got 4+2 seating. So I wanted 4 people to be able to sit in it really comfortably, and you've seen it, like those seats in the back. I mean, it's like being in the back of a limousine. There's so much leg room.
Yeah, it's
and then there's 2 little jump seats at the back that you might put a couple of kids in, but you wouldn't, you know, try to sit adults there for more than maybe a 10-minute flight. But I just wanted that capability of having those, the full 6 seats, because you know, as you know, with the kind of missions you do, sometimes you do just have that 10, 12 minute flight where you just need to get people out to an island. My brother lives on an island that's 3 hours by boat or, you know, 15 minutes by plane. And I wanted that ability to be able to, you know, pick up the family. So we went through that process with them, and then they needed about a year to get it built. And you know, I got them to paint it silver, like the first Southern Sun, because I think it makes her look, you know, in, on one, from one angle, she looks incredibly modern, but on another hand, it could be a, you know, kind of in that beach 18 sleek kind of 1930s style as well. I think you can interpret it either way.
Yeah, it is a beautiful aircraft. And, you know, looking at it when I came to see you at the museum there, I was certainly in awe. And, you know, like the tail design, like you said, with the walkway up the back, being a tail wheel flying boat as well, which is cool. You know,
yep.
It gives you that really cool beach access. And, yeah, coming through the middle of it, there's so much room with a bit of an aisle, beautiful, comfortable leather seats. Yeah, really beautiful aircraft. How are you finding it fitting into the Australian seaplane environment?
Look, she's been fine so far. I haven't done any saltwater ops yet, partly because, you know, we've had the virus and we haven't been doing any joy flights for a while. So I only got home late December. January, found myself pretty busy catching up on work. Then in February, late February, I went off to finish that retracing trip, or where I flew from Darwin around to Adelaide. And then halfway through that trip, everything started getting weird with the virus. And then by the time I got home, it was all shut down. But look, I've done some lake and river flying, and she handles things beautifully. I mean, this is a magnificent platform on the water. But I need to qualify that and just say, you know, I've been listening to your podcast. I'm listening to people have, you know, thousands of hours on all these different seaplanes. You know, I've flown a Sea Ray, and I've flown this plane, and I've done one flight in a C-Max and one flight in a Super Petrel. So, you know, my experience on seaplanes is pretty limited. I mean, I've got, you know, over 1,000 landings and over 1,000 hours, but on seaplane, but it's all basically on the same type. So I am very happy with it. I was a little bit worried that maybe I'd fallen in love with the plane and I didn't kind of know what its shortcomings were because I didn't have enough experience. But I was lucky that Dan Nickens, who is probably well known to the American pilots especially, who does a lot of flying for the Sea Ray factory and has flown extensively throughout the world on seaplanes, he came out and met me in Samara in Russia to have a look at the plane when I was taking delivery. And he took it for a fly, and I was so nervous about him doing this because I just thought, he's one of those guys who's brutally honest. He's really friendly, but he tells it as it is. And I just thought, oh, he's going to come. And I was actually losing sleep over this, that Dan was going to come back and say, you know, it's got this really nasty characteristic, or there's this, or, you know, you need to really be careful. It's like, it looks lovely, but you just got to be careful. But he came back with the biggest grin I've ever seen, and he said, that is the nicest plane I have ever flown.
Yeah, wow.
And I thought, wow, coming for him, that really meant something, because I'm always conscious of my lack of experience, and was I just getting a bit carried away? So because it's quite a long, slender hull, you know, it's 9 meters or 30 feet long, but still only kind of that 48, 50 inches wide, it really, and quite a deep V, it really cuts through the water nicely. It's got great handling on the water. And look, as you know, I mean, when you take that step from a single engine to a twin engine, the handling on the water, it just takes on a life of its own, doesn't it?
Yeah. No, that's what I found with the Mallard. It's, that thing is a bit of a beast to try and control sometimes. So it's good to hear that, you know, as a private machine, obviously, this aircraft, it's not a commercial aircraft at all. So it's more aimed at the private pilot market where, like you said, people aren't maybe more as experienced as the commercial pilot market. So it's good to hear that the flying characteristics of this aeroplane sound like they're able to be handled by lesser experienced pilots, which is obviously going to make things a lot safer for those guys.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's a very benign twin. It the engines, a bit like the Catalina, you know, the engines are high and quite close together. So when you do run it on a single engine, it there's hardly any torque at all. And I think that's partly also to do with the V-tail, because they you know, they're kind of in the slipstream, so that helps. But it and being the Rotaxes, you know, they're pretty easy engines to control. So yeah, for people who want to get some twin engine experience, or you know, just go like do some overwater flying without being quite so nervous, it's a really great platform. The planes, the wings have got pretty big tanks in them. We managed to squeeze 15 hours of fuel in the wings, which, you know, is pretty unheard of in a plane.
Absolutely, yeah.
But then we built inside the cabin, there's a couple of hatches that you open, and there's actually some fuel nipples, which are off a Honda outboard tank, because it's great what you can do in an experimental plane. So there's, yeah, the fuel fittings that you'd use for a Honda outboard engine there, and a couple of fuel pumps, so that you can actually put a bladder back in the passenger compartment and have even more fuel. So, you know, we've designed it so that it should be able to take 500 litres of fuel in the cabin and 500 litres in the wing to give me 30 hours of fuel.
Yeah, that's great. That's the great thing about those Rotaxes, isn't it? Like, they hardly burn anything, and they also burn just regular unleaded.
Yeah, it really makes a difference. I mean, I can get the fuel burn on that thing down to 15 litres a side for long-range cruise. And, you know, if you get it up high, you know, she sort of still gets along at just under 100 knots at that. But, you know, if you want to get somewhere, you burn 25 litres a side, and she'll sit on 120, 125 all day long. So it's, you know, again, it's back into those Catalina numbers. It's not super fast, but it's, you know, I think they're good, honest numbers for cross country. And, you know, I can just see some great adventures ahead with those kind of capabilities.
Absolutely. And speaking of that adventures ahead, mate, what is next on the agenda for you coming, you know, once COVID free times exist?
Yeah, look, I mean, the thing is, there are so many trips I want to do in this plane. Now, you know, I'm lucky to have flown around the world, but I haven't flown around Australia yet. So I'm really keen to do that. And to take, you know, 4 to 6 weeks to fly around Australia in this plane would just be a delight. You know, part of it for me is I also use the plane for work. So, you know, yesterday I was popping out to visit one of our country cinemas, which is great, where, you know, I can take off from the farm where we live, go to one of our cinemas, see the staff, and, you know, be home for dinner, which is really nice, because they're all, you know, in country towns. It's that old thing of, like, you can do a 5-hour drive by car or a 1-hour flight. So that's always good. You know, I've worked out that I can fly nonstop from the farm in Victoria here to New Zealand, and I am dead keen to do that within the next year, as long as I can get customs to come down and see me off. But I think that'd be pretty cool. And, you know, I'd love to fly out to the Pacific. I've been a big fan of the P.G. Taylor stories over the years of what he did with the frigate bird trips, where, you know, he took both Catalinas and Sunderlands out doing cruises through the South Pacific. He used to do trips out to Tahiti and back, stopping on lagoons, you know, and atolls all the way out there. And I am dying to do some of that flying. And, you know, I love when I do these trips to kind of share the stories and do some storytelling along the way. But, you know, I do most of that when I get home. When I'm out there, I just like to go and, you know, connect with the locals, and, you know, experience things. But, you know, we also, for instance, we do work up in East Timor and Northern Territory and Papua New Guinea with our, we have a charity, which is a traveling cinema program. And, you know, I've even done that using the Sea Ray, but to be able to do it in this plane, where I can put some fold up cinema equipment in the back of the plane and go and visit some really remote places that, you know, the parts of Papua New Guinea we take to, it takes 2 days to get there commercially. So, yeah, you might as well put all your gear in the back of the plane, and I can get there in the same amount of time flying at 120 knots. So, I think that would be amazing, and to go to some of those places and to take that program out into some Pacific islands where, you often find yourself going to people who've never seen a movie on a screen. You know, that maybe they've got a TV, but they've never seen projected images. And the idea of being there with groups of people, you know, families of three generations sitting around having that cinema experience where you enjoy a story with everyone laughing together is something really special to share with someone for the first time.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. Obviously, your background, pretty obvious now that you've mentioned it, is cinemas. And I think that's really cool about the private pilot industry is you're working, or you, all these pilots generally have some sort of very interesting background like that, you know, whereas us flying boat pilots, we're just pilots, you know what I mean? don't have any other backstory other than my little side podcast project. But I mean, you know about the one in Darwin here, the beautiful Darwin outdoor cinema, the Deck Chair.
Yeah, we love it. It's one of the great cinemas of Australia, the Deck Chair. It's beloved in Darwin. And, you know, I love that it's one of those things that when people visit Darwin from, you know, interstate or overseas, a bit like if you're going to Broome, you've got to go to the outdoor cinema. And I've actually done a couple of screenings there in the past, and we're just, trying to see if we can do something this year up at the cinema there. So, yeah.
Well, that's where I saw your DVD, mate, at the Deck Chair Cinema in Darwin.
Oh, did you? Oh, yeah, fantastic.
And they also did it was like a fundraising night, and they had Top Gun on. So I've seen Top Gun at that cinema, which is pretty cool. And hopefully they're going to put Top Gun 2 on when that eventually comes down the track, because it'd be awesome to see it in the outdoor cinema there as well.
Yeah, they will. So, you know, for all the people, you know, Top Gun was meant to be coming out in June, and we thought it was going to just, you know, absolutely set this time of the year on fire. But unfortunately, you know, they've postponed it, but it's now coming out at Christmas. So,
yeah.
It's going to be huge. I can't wait to do some stuff with that, doing double features of the original film and that.
Oh, that's crazy. Yeah. Not more goosebumps, more goosebumps. mate, it's awesome being talking all about your little aircraft there, the Sea Bear L-65, was it? L-65?
Yes, that's it, yep.
So make sure you go and check that. Like I said, I'll have some links down in the show notes at the bottom there. Mate, before we get going today, normally finish the chat here with a splash and dash questionnaire, just like the land plane touch and go. The seaplane splash and dash. We'll touch on a few questions. Mate, what would be your dream seaplane just to fly? I know you've got your dream seaplane to own now, but what out there, you've recreated some pretty amazing flights of some old seaplanes, but what would be your dream seaplane to fly?
Look, you'd probably think I'd say the Catalina, but, you know, John Delay tells me that she's actually a bit of a pig to fly. So I tell you what, there's this idea I've had for years. So my dream would be to, A, have the time, the resources and the know-how, which I've kind of got a little bit of each of those things, to build a scale model, flyable by one person, Spruce Goose. I've had this idea for years that I'd like to build a Spruce Goose about 20, 25 feet long, which I suppose it'd have about a 40-foot wingspan, that had 8 electric engines on it. And I'd love to build that thing so you could fit it in a container and take it to an air show and just do, you know, bizarre trips in an all-electric Spruce Goose.
That sounds epic. Let's try and make this happen, I reckon. We should get behind this and... get the Spruce Goose flying again.
How kooky would it be to see the Spruce Goose coming into land on your local lake, and then the top opens up and there's just one head in it? I just think it'd be hilarious.
Do it. And then you've got to make sure you haven't shaved and you haven't cut your hair for at least 3 years when you get out of it. So.
Yeah, and I've got the fedora. Yes, that's sitting there somewhere. Yeah, I must say he is one of my heroes. One of my favourite planes. I saw it down at... at Kermit's place, at the Fantasy of Flight, is the Sikorsky S-38. I mean, you know, in many ways, a modern version of that would be the ultimate adventure plane. If you could do an all composite version with, you know, I love the way it's got the big leather couch in the back, and he had the little, you know, in the film The Aviator, where he opens the fridge door to get his bottle of milk out. I just thought, how cool is that?
So, another great film.
Yeah, I just watched that again recently, and that... some of the flying scenes in that were amazing. But, you know, it's interesting. That film came out just as I was making the decision to get my pilot's license. And it's partly what really tipped me into saying, okay, I'm just going to focus on flying boats. I'd always wanted to get my pilot's license, but I'd always kind of come and gone and come and gone. And the two things that tipped me in were that film. And I thought, I really think that would be fun. And I just love that scene where he lands pulls up on the beach and walks in to you know, where they film the film set. And then at the same time, there was the Australian Flying magazine came out, and on the front cover was a Sea Ray. And I just, you know, I followed up this Sea Ray thing, and I actually went and bought a secondhand one before I even finished my license. I was so committed to this idea of flying off the water that it, you know, it's like 90% of my hours of flying are all in flying boats.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And that's the other good thing about the Sea Ray, isn't it? Just like, it's pretty cheap relatively for aircraft. So, you know, most people can afford one as well.
Absolutely. You can get a good secondhand one in America for, you know, the cost of a car. I mean, they're just not expensive.
Mm. Mate, next question. You've got a lake, a river, a coral cay, or open ocean. What would be your favourite place to land a seaplane on in those four options?
Look, I haven't landed on a coral cay yet, so I think that would be my favourite if I'd done it, but generally I'd prefer a lake. I've done a lot of saltwater landings, and the saltwater landings don't bother me, but the hour of washing the plane afterwards does.
Well, do you have to do that with the Sea Bear at all, because it's all composite?
Look, it won't be as bad. The Sea Ray, I had to be really thorough, but
yeah.
Because this plane's all composite, it's really only around the landing gear and a few hinges. So I think it's actually going to be pretty good. I need to just pull my finger out and get out there and do some.
You're a seaplane pilot now, mate. You got to get your fingers wet and hands dirty at the end of a flight. You got to wash those planes down.
Absolutely, but I don't have the engineering team and resources that you have at your disposal.
True, fair enough. I'm surprised you didn't say open ocean, mate, after telling us you've landed on the equator in open ocean. Maybe that scared you off the open ocean flying.
Yeah, let's just say I didn't notice the swell until after I'd landed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mate, you've kind of mentioned, it kind of goes back to the last question, but where is the best place that you've actually landed a seaplane?
Oh, geez, to name one is so hard. Look, I think the most romantic place was Lake Como. But landing on a lake on Adak Island in the middle of the Aleutian Islands, I think was the coolest place ever. I mean, that place is like a moonscape. It is the most bizarre place in the world. And I think that was something I'll always be really glad I did.
Yeah, very cool. Last one I've got here is usually I ask for some advice for aspiring seaplane pilots to go into a commercial role, but maybe it's more topical to go for what advice would you give for some aspiring private seaplane owners out there if they wanted to buy an aircraft?
Yeah, sure. Look, so let's assume that most of the people you're talking about will generally be reasonably low time. So I, like a lot of listeners, went to Jack Brown to get my seaplane endorsement because I had a American license first and then my Australian license second. And you know, that's a 3-day course, which isn't overly taxing. And at the end of it, I think you're ready to kind of very carefully increase your capabilities, not, you know, to go too crazy. But my advice to private pilots, reasonably low time, who want to get into flying off the water is get to know your plane really well. I mean, when I bought that Sea Ray, I went and spent a couple of days with Kerry Richter at the Sea Ray factory flying and just getting to know the plane really well. And then a bit of time with Paige there as well. But, you know, they did great exercises like go to one end of a lake, fly across it for 3 miles at a foot above the water and try to just kiss it and come up again and really get that sense of being just above the water. And I think, you know, most commercial pilots, by the time they're doing commercial seaplane work, you've got such great experience, but also amazing discipline. The discipline is built into you guys in a way it isn't with us as private pilots. And you know, so I decided I was going to get to know that plane really, really well before I kind of went flying off the water in earnest, and especially before I was carrying passengers. I probably did 50 or 100 water landings and probably got 50 or 100 hours under my belt before I was confident enough to actually start taking passengers with me. And I know a lot of people probably wouldn't wait that long and you might say I was overly cautious, but I just think build your skills, but also you know it's kind of seat of the pants flying. But once you're putting someone else in there, I know everyone's had those bad landings, you know, where you bounce the hell out of the plane, and maybe private pilots have a few more of them. I just you don't want to be doing them with other people in the plane.
Fair call, fair call.
Does that kind of make sense?
Mate, that's great advice, great advice. I think a lot of people out there would, I think go out there, make sure you really know the airplane. I mean, most pilots really should know the airplane that they're flying in as good as possible. And I guess the level of flight training for private pilots is obviously generally not as high as commercial. They don't have to go through the extra training to get that commercial license. So there's an understanding there that probably the skill level's not going to be as high when they finish that private license. But so, you know, the threat is there that, you know, taking a plane out straight away, the skill level's not going to be as high, and there's that chance for mistakes to happen. So yeah, going out by yourself and really getting to know your airplane really makes a lot of sense. So yeah
and to do the, you know, just to go out for days and just practice, you know, before you go heading off cross country and doing all those things. I mean, I'd just go off for, you know, I'd go off and fly for 2 or 3 hours and just do landing after landing after landing, and, you know, just eke your way around the corner into those slightly bigger waves and then go back to the flat water and really get that, you know, really get the feel for it. So yeah, just spend time with it.
Absolutely, mate. Well, thanks very much, Michael Smith, for coming on the show, mate. You might only have low 1,000 hours of water time and water landings, but you've certainly done some pretty incredible flying and taking the plane, or two planes now, into some pretty amazing places around the world. So very envious, and I love hearing your stories and reading your books and watching the movie there of your first trip. And, you know, your stories remind me a lot of, you know, those early days of Kingsford Smith taking on the world, basically. And it's great to have you on the show, mate, and thanks very much for coming on The Step.
Oh, mate, it's been my pleasure. Well done on the show, by the way. It's great to bring the aviation community together through this platform. So well done.
Cheers, mate. All the best.
Okay. Catch you later, everyone.
And that's the show for today, folks. What an adventurer Michael Smith is. And thanks to Michael for coming on the show and sharing his amazing story. And don't forget to leave a review, folks. This is the time now to go and review the podcast and the episode. Share the podcast around, as I mentioned earlier in the episode. Tell everyone about it, and let's all together grow on The Step. And before we go, episode 15 is another story of adventure from an airline pilot taking long breaks from his cushy 787 job to chase the seaplane dream. That's right, folks, taking leave without pay from an airline gig to go back to GA flying out bush. You don't hear that often, and here's a taste.
I got word from someone, there was a Piper Cup at the top of the South Island and it may be available for training. So I got a hold of the guy, who was pretty abrupt, and said it's not available for training. Unless you got $100,000, you could buy it, but other than that, I can't help you. And because he was a bit of a dick, I was like, yeah, no, that's cool. I got $100,000. Where do we go from here? And the sort of phone went quiet. And of course, I didn't have $100,000, but, you know, I just didn't like the tone of this guy. Eh? So, yeah, anyway, a friend went and checked out the plane and I bought it.
Absolutely pumped to get the legend himself, Shane McCauley, and his episode out this week. But until next time, everyone, thanks very much for coming on The Step.